Okay.
Could you please state your full name, your date of birth, and your place of birth?
I'm Dr. Evelyn Sears Peavy. I was born February the 16th, 1923, in Norfolk, Virginia. I'm one of 15 children born to Mr. and Mrs. William Harvey Sears. I'm the seventh child in that pack of 15. Okay.
What community were you living in?
We grew up in a Huntersville neighborhood on Washington Avenue, corner of Proger Street. And during that time, Huntersville was quite a nice neighborhood. All of the professional people lived in the neighborhood. My parents had two places of business in the neighborhood.
What kind of business?
One of them was, we call it the Sears Confectionery, because at that place we also had a contract with the U.S. Postal Service, and we had a post office there in the store. And so when we became 18, the federal officials swore us in, and we were able to write money orders and mail packages and all. It was the only one that's ever been in the black community, and it was substation number 9. The other one was my daddy ended up making it a sports arena. He had wrestling matches, and that was on Chapel Street, whereas now Tidewater Drive is right in the middle of where his other business was. And they called it Sears Arena also because he had an arena there where they would have parties, clubs would rent it for parties and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And so your mother worked in the business as well?
She worked in... Well, we're 15 children. She was at the house. But the house was part of the store. Back in that time, the front part was the store, and the back was the house, and the upstairs was the house. And so the younger ones of us would be placed on a stool, and when somebody came in the store, we would say, inside. And that means Mama would come from the back part of the house, you know, into the store. Uh-huh.
So, what school did you first go to?
We all went to John T. West Elementary School, which is idle now on Bolton Street. And from there, we went to Booger T. All of us went to Booger T. And you want to know my school and beyond that?
Sure.
When I finished high school, I was accepted at Hampton. It was Hampton Institute then, because I had a sister 6 years older than I am. And she had finished Hampton. We all trooped over there for her commencement, and we all became excited about attending college. And so five of us girls all finished Hampton. Okay. And I got my master's at Hampton also, because when I finished Hampton, I did my student teaching right there in the laboratory school, and I came back to Norfolk to teach. And the disciplinary things were so much out of whack from what I had studied. So I went right back to begin graduate studies because I was in search of something to help motivate the children to learn. You know?
Okay. So your neighborhood in Huntersville,
mm-hmm.
was it like a diverse community? People did all types of things?
Yes, it really was. The whole neighborhood was diverse. But I tell you one thing, everybody looked out for all the children. Whatever any of us did, if we were out on the street, our neighbor would say, I'm going to tell your mama, I'm going to tell your daddy. And so it was really the whole neighborhood rearing us. Mm-hmm. But there were all kinds of people in the neighborhood. But there was a caring relationship. I don't ever remember locking a door. I don't think we had a key to the family.
And you said that in your father's arena, it was sports?
Mm-hmm. It was a sports arena, but then there was also a part of it. The sports arena was on the outside, and then the inside, it was set up for clubs, and dances, and that kind of thing.
So would entertainers ever come?
No, we used the jukebox, called it. Oh, the bands that came in, local bands. Mm-hmm.
And how did your parents start to get into business? How did they first get into it?
Well, my mother said that when she married my father, he already had a little grocery store. And so he was considered a very prominent little fella in the community. Okay.
Do you know how he first became interested in that?
I really don't. All I know is he had that. But then he also owned a jitney. They call it a jitney, but it was a bus. Mm-hmm. He had his little black bus company. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And he was a wrestler because we have pictures of him in a wrestling outfit. Mm-hmm. I said he was a years ahead of him, of his time. Mm-hmm. So we never had to worry about food to eat. And a lot of folk gave my mother clothes, though. Not that mama asked for them. And she'd make them old to have little dresses because she would embroider them. Mm-hmm. Put little designs on the little jackets and things. Mm-hmm.
And you were the seventh child, so were you responsible for some of the younger ones?
Yes. And a midwife came every time my mother was expecting. We didn't know she was expecting because she wore big aprons. Mm-hmm. But every 2 years when the midwife showed up, we knew another child was on the way. And that midwife would order us around. And the last child was born the year I was a senior in high school. And I really call it an insult. Now, here I'm getting ready to go off to college. My mother had a baby. But me and my baby sister, who is the 15th child in the family, are very close now. But she really didn't know me when she was coming up. Because, see, I went on off to college and came home and married the same year. Had no children, taught. And I would get over my house like weekends. Mm-hmm. And she looked forward to that, you know. Uh-huh. Yeah, but we had to take care of each other. Mm-hmm.
And what kinds of responsibilities might you have had?
I cooked. I sewed. I remember I had to sew my brothers. You know, if they lost buttons on the shirt, it was my job to sew them on. Because I was next to the oldest girl, and since the oldest one was gone, I had a lot of responsibility. I did a lot of cooking and sewing, plus working in the store. And I got my lessons while I was working in the store. I always felt that my mother had a heavy load and I wanted to do all I could to help her. So some of my brothers and sisters kind of called me Miss Goody Two-Shoes.
what made your sister going to Hampton made you want to go to Hampton?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what was it like when you got there?
It was just fine. It was virtuous living because the dean of women stress virtue. Certain things Hampton women didn't do. We had to wear our gloves and our hat to go shopping in town. And we had all these teas on Sunday afternoon and we wore our gloves for that and our little hats. And the dean of women kept saying that certain things Hampton women don't do. We didn't smoke, we didn't wear pants or any of those kinds of things. I was holding hands with a fella who's like a brother to me on campus one day. And she said, little lady, Hampton women don't hold hands. Mm-hmm. So some of the virtuous things that she taught us, we never forgotten because we had seminars for us. Okay. And I ended up working on the desk as a receptionist. The whole 4 years I was at Hampton, even though I had a scholarship, I worked also to keep some pressure off my parents with the other brothers and sisters that were coming along. So I would make the mail list, sort the mail, make a mail list. Answer the phone, and when the fellas came to call, I'd call the room for the girls.
So you worked in a dorm?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what did you study after?
In the dormitory.
So what was your major when you were here?
English. Minored in social studies. I was always fascinated with English because in high school, the teachers said, C.S.,
major.
Yeah, majored in English. Because when I was in high school, I could write well. And when teachers had emergencies, they would send for me to teach the class. I don't know how they allowed that to happen because it couldn't happen nowadays. But I would sit in there and teach a class. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So teaching wasn't anything new to you?
And then, too, I used to teach around the house. I always would get my younger brothers and sisters together and play school with them. Mm-hmm. So teaching was natural for me to go into. Okay.
And so you said you taught for a period of time, and then you went back to get your master's.
Okay, what happened to me? I finished college, married the same year, fell back home. Now, that was the biggest mistake I ever made in my life because it didn't work. But for 3 years, it was fine. But the day that I came home from the hospital after being married 3 years with that first child, the marriage was never the same. Okay, because the baby cried all night the first night, and he was said, get up and see about the baby. And I stayed home, though, with a master's degree, because I went on, I told you I started on my master's. And I stayed home 6 years. And by the time I realized my marriage was really in bad shape, and the girls in my sorority convinced me that it was time for me to go back to work, I really didn't have a pair of shoes that didn't need half soling. Okay, so I've been through the hard time thing. Okay.
What sorority?
I belong to Iota Phi Lambda Sorority. It's a business and professional women's sorority. When I was at Hampton, they did not have sororities and fraternities because we were heavily endowed by rich folk up in the New England state, rich whites. And so they were against, they call it a luxury. So when I finished and came home and they were organizing this particular sorority, they invited me to join. And I attended the first national in 1956, and I have never missed the national convention. I've been national president of the group and all of that. So it's been a nice, it's not a big sorority. It was founded by businesswomen in the community who felt that the salvation for black women was through business. And so our whole focal point is to encourage young women to pursue business careers. And we give scholarships all over the country, and including St. Thomas in the very, we give scholarships to worthy young ladies who want to major in business. Mm-hmm. In fact, we just had a national here 2 weeks ago at the Omni Hotel. Okay.
So you went back to work?
I went back to work. And remember, I was teaching English when I went back. But somewhere my principal saw my transcript and saw that a lot of social studies courses were guidance related. And she put me in guidance part-time and had me teaching part-time. And then one summer, I had an opportunity to study at Virginia State in counseling. I took advantage of that. Then I went to Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. By then I was a divorcee. And I was buying a home by myself for the three children. But I had friends keeping my children while I studied during the summer. Then I studied at San Diego State University in San Diego one summer. And all of these were federally funded programs for which I received a stipend, and there was money for my children. So while I was studying, I was sending money for whoever was caring for them. But San Diego State taught me the biggest lesson of my life, because it was while I was studying out there that summer, everybody had their master's degree, and so there were no grades attached. But my two younger children ran away from home. They were with my sister in Hampton. And they said my sister was pregnant and she was evil to them. So the two younger children, they were about 10 and 12. Got the little money that I was sending them for spending change, got on their bicycles, went to the grocery store over in Hampton, bought lunch and meat and bread, and went to the recreation playground and played all day. My sister finally found them, whipped them profusely, and made them sit down and write me and tell me what they had done. And I got that letter. And I cried. I said, here I am out here in California trying to learn what to do to help other people. And my own children are suffering. And I never left them again. I started taking them with me to all of the regional conferences and all of the national conventions. Because I said it wasn't worth it if I lose my own children. Okay. So we laugh about it now, but it really was heartbreaking for my children.
What year were you in San Diego?
I was in San Diego in 1962, because that same year I was able to get a train ticket that was called a circuit ticket. And I kept exploring things that I didn't even really know about. I asked, was there such a thing? Because I wanted to study for either 6 or 9 weeks at San Diego State. And I figured they would accept me in the program since I was probably be the only one from Virginia, and I was, because most of them West Coast. And then the World's Fair was going on in Seattle. And the sorority was having this national convention in Seattle. So I got the circuit ticket. Went to school and stayed, got that same ticket, got on the train, went all the way up to Seattle. Came back by way of Chicago after the sorority convention was over and came on back to Norfolk and picked up my children from Hampton. Mm-hmm.
So did you meet any kinds of difficulties with segregation when you were growing up?
When I was studying?
Or when you were growing up?
You know, actually, from my parents having the store, salesmen were coming and going. The postal workers, officials were coming and going. And, you know, we looked at people as people. We never talked about racism or any of that. So for me, it was like a colorless world. And even when I went to Hampton, the dorm directors were white from up in the New England state. Half of my teachers were white. The most I experienced was when I came to back to Norfolk, after I had gone back to work, and after I became head of my guidance department, and they began integrating the schools. And they sent two women over from a Northside junior high school who were counselors there, and they didn't want to come, and they didn't want to work on a black. And I had a time with them, because they were used to sitting in the lounge reading the paper. And what I'd do is go through the lounge to go to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, don't come over here checking on me. I said, I don't have time to check on you. I had to use the restroom. And you see, that was when I began to realize this thing, this racism is here. Here these ladies going to come to this black junior high school and sit around, read the paper, or sit in the lounge and could care less about counseling our children. Mm-hmm. And then I began to experience it a little more when they sent an assistant principal over to Jaycox, who decided that all of the children ought to be to school on time, unless they were being bused in. So who was being bused in? The white children. Because they were coming from Ocean View and other places in the city. And so whenever the bus was late, they'd make an announcement. He'd make an announcement on the PA system. Excuse so-and-so, bus number so-and-so, it just arrived. But any black child, and the housing projects were right behind the school, any black child who walked across the door 1 minute past 8, you're late. And they took their name 3 times. And after 3 times being tardy, they suspended them. And our black children were being suspended at a disproportionate amount of thing. And I got a copy of all of the suspensions because I was head of the guidance department. So I started doing a statistical study of it. And I wrote a paper and sent it down to the assistant superintendent who was in charge of counseling and all of that to say, we need to take a look at what is happening to our children. I really started sending for parents. The black parents, I sent a postcard and said, please come out for a group session on Friday. Whoever was suspended all of 1 week, that next Friday, I wanted the parent out there. Most of them didn't even know the child had been suspended. Okay. The other thing that truly opened my eyes was one boy who was suspended for like 10 days. On a Friday evening, he went down to the Trailway bus station. At that time, the Trailway bus station was on Main Street. It had a separate place from Greyhound. He and one of his buddies robbed a white sailor and killed him. He's still in prison. And this is another reason I knew I had to do some additional study. And I happened to put my doctorate because in the process of all that was happening at the school, and incidentally for the children that were suspended, based on our conference with the assistant superintendent, And he came unexpectedly one day, and we met till after like 5:30 in the evening at school. I said, isn't that something we can do to keep these children in school rather than have them out on the street? And that's when they began the in-school suspension. Mm-hmm. Okay. But the redneck assistant principal was very angry with me. The next morning he used profanity, and I had to say, let me tell you something. I have not reported you. I simply reported what has happened in this school. So don't use your profanity with me, because I don't accept that from anybody. And I don't let anybody use profanity around me. I tell them, I don't accept that, so you can stop. And I experienced it further on the electoral board. When I retired, I was appointed by City Council of Norfolk to the board that governs the election. And for 300 years, there was not a black on that board. And here I was, and one day at a meeting, one of the whites on the board, there were two white men, was very kind and gentle to me. He knew my background. The other one knew nothing about me. The other one was a Republican, and he was very racist. And one day at the meeting, he said, "Damn, Evelyn," to me. I said, "Just a moment. I resent that. Because, see, I'm a lady, and nobody uses profanity to me." He apologized, but I was the only black in the room. There were some white ladies there. They didn't say anything. But then later on, they told me they was glad I did it. But I had to constantly, so he started saying, I would say something, but it would offend Evelyn, so I won't say it. Okay. So I began to realize that this thing is alive and well, just, I guess in the last 20 years, because, people were people before that. And I realize now that in order to make it, you've got to speak up, and you've got to know that you're right when you speak up. Okay. I was chairman of the board of Tidewater Community College, and I got along fine there. They had great respect for me as I chaired the board. I stayed on that board 8 years. My term was just up June the 30th. I came off the electoral board as of March the 1st. I'd been on it 9 years, and it was beginning to take a physical toll on me, because you get on duty 5:00 in the morning. You have a policeman driving you around from precinct to precinct. What I had them to do on my name tag is put Dr. ESP, because I said, I will not stand for anybody that I go to see what they're doing at the precinct to call me by my first name. So I said, don't even put it on my badge. And that's how I got around it when I went out in the field. Yeah, whether they liked it or not. And I think the policemen who carried me around, they had little jokes kind of quietly. Because one or two times they shipped me off to the only black who was on the detail. And I could see how subtly they were doing it, because I was more than they wanted to reckon with. But I had to stay in my ground. But I try to do it as professionally as I can. I try very hard when I'm working with the other race is to say my name is and use the whole title. Mm-hmm. The folk that I don't mind calling me by the first name, I will tell them, you can call me Evelyn. I end up saying to an electoral board meeting, it's all right to call me Evelyn, but don't use profanity around me. Okay. And whatever decisions I made when I was on that board, I always tried to make sure I was right before I made them. Because at one point, I went to a certain precinct, heavily in the middle of the black community, and there was this black fella there. Said he was observing the election process. I said, let me see your credentials. He was from New York State. I said, you're not a registered voter in Norfolk. What are you doing? He said, the Republican Party sent me here. I said, I'm sorry. You cannot come in here to observe anything if you're not a registered voter for the city of Norfolk. And I said, so you must leave. And leave right now. The policeman was standing right there listening to him, because I always kept the policeman at my side. In that particular instance, the chairman of the Republican Party ordered me back to the voting precinct. So On the car phone, the policeman, to be alert, who was escorting me around that day, ordered two backup cars. So by the time I got back, there were six policemen going in with me to make sure, no harm would befall me. So he said, what is all of this about? So the policeman said, I ordered them to come. And I said, what is the problem? And I said, this young man, he ended up saying he'd stay there himself because he realized that I caught him wrong. And what I find they do on election time is try to do subtle things thinking that we won't catch them. And now the board is all white because I tried to get ample notice to the black community that I was no longer wishing to be on the board. Because after the day after the election, you have to go down to circuit court to verify the results. And I was secretary of the board, and I had to read the results for the last two or three elections. And the day after I read them, I lost my voice for a week. And the doctor said, you were overusing your voice box. And I said, you know, this could be serious if it continues. And that was the reason I didn't want to, but they didn't want me. The black community couldn't find anybody to recommend to replace me.
Okay.
So, you said that you really didn't feel the effects of racism when you were growing up?
When I was young, I really didn't. Because I guess we knew what our boundaries were. Mm-hmm. And we just respected the boundaries. Mm-hmm. Forgive me.
Okay.
But you were saying you knew your boundaries?
Yeah, and we knew what the boundaries were, and then people were people, because I told you all of them we saw. And then, you know, we had our confectionery on one corner. Across the corner was a Jewish-owned grocery store. And we had close relationship with the little fellow over there, come over there and play with my brothers. And we just had a nice relationship. We had our own church and all of that.
What church did you attend?
First Baptist on Butte Street is 195 years old now.
And you said before that a midwife delivered all your mothers.
Yes.
Was that unusual for that time?
No, that's what happened during that time. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people said here that they went to the hospital.
See, now, I went to the hospital when I had my children, but when my parents and everybody I know in her age category had midwives.
And do you know anything about the midwife? Because I hadn't heard of a midwife operating.
All I know is when she came, the one who came with us, the one we said, Miss Lula. Miss Lula came in with her little bag that looked like a doctor's bag. Mm-hmm. She ordered us to get paper. We had to heat water. Mm-hmm. And evidently she put the paper under my mother. And then she evidently used the water to sterilize the utensils that she was using, like to cut the cord and all of that kind of thing. And all I know beyond that is my mother always stayed upstairs for 30 days. And we mainly took her hot tea and crackers, soda crackers. She was on a light diet, but she did not carry out any physical activity for 30 days with all 15 of the children. We knew that we had to work for a month when a baby was born. Uh-huh.
Where did you shop in Norfolk?
On Church Street.
And you would do like your clothing shopping?
Hmm?
Your clothing shopping.
Yeah, but see, most of our things, a lot of them were given to us. My mother had a first cousin who lived in New Jersey, and she'd send us packages of very nice clothes. So our shopping was minimal. You know, it was mainly under thing. But I tell you, because of the fact that we were given things and mama redesigned things, That's one of my weakest areas. I love nice clothes. And I do spend money buying them on sale. I catch the sale, but I'm not going to anymore in my life buy anything that's cheap. I want to look at the quality of it. And if it's a good quality and it's half price, I'd rather buy that than to buy something that's regular price, that's minimal quality. So everybody says, I tell you, you're something with your clothes. But I do love nice clothes. Mm-hmm.
The hairdresser, where would you go when you were like a teenager? Where would you get your hair done?
My sister did my hair until she went off to college. And then there was a lady down the street who did hair at her house. And looked like we paid her like $5. And she do that hard pressing of your hair and curling it. And then we finally, I guess by the time I got to college, there was a beautician around the corner that I go to during the summers. But when I was in Hampton, I didn't come home often. I came home Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Easter. I did not want to come home because I knew if I came home, I had to put down my bag, go in the store and work, and take care of my younger brothers and sisters. And I didn't come. But so over on the campus, we had the a beauty parlor on the bottom floor of one of the dorms. Mm-hmm. But I never had all these fancy styles and all hairdo.
Mm-hmm. I'll ask you, do you know of any political activity, people who were involved in the NAACP?
Now, when they had them, I was president of the campus chapter of the NAACP when I was at Hampton. And I remember Hampton putting me on a train, sending me to Lincoln University, where all of the college NAACP chapters met. But I can't remember anything that we did on campus that exposed racism. Mm-hmm. We were just meeting, and it was more like a club than being out there doing anything. Mm-hmm. It really was. But I never got active with it when I came home. They're still asking me to get active with the NAACP. I paid my membership dues. When I was national president of the sorority paid. That was one of the things each national president got was a life membership. Okay. But I have not been actively involved in that. But I did go to the March on Washington that took place somewhere during the 70s. I really did. I got on one of them. And when the freedom fighters came through here, freedom riders, I housed one at my house when I was a single parent. And I remember he was so smelly and musty and grisly looking. But we wanted to, you know, they wanted people to volunteer. And since I was teaching school, I thought it was good experience for my children to meet one of the people and all. But he stayed like overnight with us. We gave him a meal and all. And tried to encourage him to please take a good bath. Mm-hmm. He came from Mississippi somewhere. And they were on their way to Washington. Mm-hmm.
Do you know?
I was working day in the public school system, night at Norfolk State teaching freshman composition. And I did that for 10 years. Until Mr. Peaver came along and I married him. I was living, buying a house in another part of town when he found this house because he said he wanted the folk in Norfolk to know that he could provide for me. So he found this house, this home, and this is where we moved. All the children, my three children were all in college when he married me, and each one was in a different state. Okay.
And where did you finish your doctorate?
At Virginia Tech in Blacksburg. My doctorate is in counseling student personnel services.
And what year did you
finish? In 1981. Mm-hmm. And my area of my dissertation is on leisure counseling over the lifespan, because what a professor at Virginia Tech, the head of the counseling department, had done some research in it, in that area. And I did an internship at the Department of Education while I was at Tech one whole summer. And he had me doing research in the Library of Congress. And I found out that there were mainly physical ed people writing about leisure counseling. There weren't enough people in the counseling field. And so my thing was from the counseling perspective, because what I was advocating is, in order to thoroughly counsel a person, you need to understand what they do during their leisure time. Mm-hmm. And in it, I remembered how the fellas around Norfolk were standing on street corners. And my thing was saying that you need to teach children what to do with their leisure time, even from little tots. Mm-hmm. Okay? So some of my material has been published by the professor. I suppose I've been co-authoring a book with him, and I haven't gotten around to it yet. Okay.
In your community when you were growing up, if there were ever problems or difficulties, who were like the community leaders? Who would people turn to?
They would turn to the ministers. The various church ministers, mainly. They were truly the leaders in the community. And the principals. Mm-hmm. Look like in the community, if you were a preacher's child, or you were a mail carrier's child, an educator's child, you got a pretty good shape. You know, you kind of survived nicely. The drawback for me and my children was that since I was a divorcee, I always tried to be like mother hen, wanting to know where they were, because I never wanted their father to scoop them up mm-hmm. and disappear with them. But they came through the same junior high school where I worked, mm-hmm. and that was not fair to them. And I would never advocate that happening, because one day my older daughter was out in the hall as I was passing the hall. I said, "What are you doing out here in the hall?" She was chewing gum. Teachers say, "Your mother's a guidance counselor. You're in here chewing gum. Get out." She's standing outside the door. Another time, a science teacher came to me because my younger daughter, he had been out the room. He came back in, and the children were talking. And he said, "What are you doing talking like this?" And he said, "Pat, I'll tell your mother on you. I'll go get your mother on you." And so my daughter said, "Go get her." Because she had to defend herself in front of her peers, right? And he came to get me. And all I did was go to the door of the science room. And they heard, I said, "Ooh." And I said, "Come here, sweetheart." I talked to her quiet in the hall. She said, "Mama, he tried to set me up for an example." Because everybody was talking. But when he said he was going to get you, I said, "Go on and get you then." Because I said, "Just keep your mouth quiet. And I'll see you when you get home." We just talked about it. But I was not going to humiliate her. But it was not easy. When my son saw me on the hall, he just said, my name was Taylor. Then he, "Hi, you Miss Taylor?" And he was along with the fellas. He never said Mom. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And do you remember anyone voting when you were growing up?
Oh, now that's something that my father stressed, was the voting. When all of us got 18, we had to register to vote. My daddy made certain of that, and we paid that little poll tax and all of that. So voting was heavily stressed in family life. Mm-hmm. It really was. We look forward, no, not 18, 21.
21.
Yeah, I'm sorry, 21. Because I was finishing Hampton when I registered to vote. Looked like I came home to register. Oh, yeah, it was heavily stressed. You're supposed to have been somebody if you reached 21 and registered to vote.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So most people didn't vote?
Yeah, we did. Those of us in college, we all talked about becoming 21 and voting. We look forward to it. Okay. But I understand there's a segment of the community who declared they weren't going to bother. But we all did.
Okay. All right, then.
Claire Acton, she's 2 years younger than I am, but she's very involved. And when she knew the politicians, and she'd have gatherings right in our family home where the politicians would come and talk with the people in the black community. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
So most of the black community did vote?
The ones that I knew did vote, because the political people would come and talk to them about why they wanted to be elected and all of that. That happened, you know, it went on. Mm-hmm.
And the poll tax, how high?
I'm trying to remember what it was. I don't remember whether it was $5. What I don't remember what it was. It was minimal, but still it was not fair that it would be a poll tax. I knew personally the man, the attorney who pushed it through the Supreme Court. He was a contemporary of mine. And I know personally the lady, Evelyn Butts, who was a plaintiff in the case. She just died last year. And she was politically active. Okay. The attorney was Joe Jordan. He ended up being a judge in the Norfolk court system.
So there was a real concern about voting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I remember my government teacher my senior year in high school talked about the importance of it. So it was kind of infiltrated in us that we at 21 should vote.
Mm-hmm. Okay.